I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Humphrey Bower. Welcome.
Hi, Michael.
Well, here we are in the Hamilton Hill Memorial Hall. Isn't this a place?
It's a marvellous place, isn't it? I don't know much about the history of it, but it looks like it's been recently renovated for hire. I love these buildings. I mean, I'm guessing it might be, I'm just going to guess and say Art Deco era, but it's hard to say. It could be older. Looks like there's some nice old brickwork and limestone on the outside. And then they've got a beautiful stage, actually, Prozart stage, and curtains so you can black it out if you need to have blackout for theatre or performance. And then this marvellous bank of seating that they've installed, which is retractable.
Looks like a compactus where you push it back with all the files in it.
That's right. So it's flattened against the back wall at the moment, but it looks like you could pull it forward and have tiered seating, like four or five rows of seating.
It's just stupendous. I must find out more about it. But what are you doing here, Humphrey?
Look, that's a good question, Michael. I'm rehearsing here at the moment for a theatre show that I'm doing actually at the Moores Building Art Space in a few weeks' time. Which is an adaptation for the stage of a novel by David Malouf, the great Australian writer, which is called An Imaginary Life.
A lot of people will have read it.
I would say so. I read it back in the, I'm going to say late 70s or early 80s when it came out, when I was at school actually then. And I think it's one of his earliest books, first or second novel, actually. Malouf, for people who don't know, is a poet as well as a novelist, and I think he's just recently turned 90. And he's really, to me, he's sort of... I hesitate to invoke Patrick White because that's a bit of a forbidding...
Well, I think Malouf does that.
Well, I think they were friends, and, I think Malouf is a slightly more approachable writer than Patrick White.
About 100% more approachable.
Yeah. It's hard to be much less approachable than Patrick White. I love Patrick White, actually. But this novel is called An Imaginary Life, and it is an imaginary reconstruction of the final years in the life of the Roman poet Ovid, who we know was exiled from Rome to the outskirts of the empire, to a small village on the edge of the Black Sea in, I suppose, what would be modern day, I'm going to guess, Romania or Bulgaria or, the Balkans.
The Roman Empire was a wonderful thing.
Well,
went all the way out there.
It was wonderful for the Romans, and I think it was wonderful for some of the people who were subjugated and not others. But this is in the early stages of the empire, actually. It's Augustus was emperor. And, Ovid, for people who don't know, is probably most famous for writing love poetry and kind of mythological fables. I mean, his most famous work is the Metamorphoses, which is a kind of compendium of Greek mythology from, in Latin. So it's from a kind of a Roman perspective. But very playful, very erotic, very sensual. And he also wrote the Amores, which are a series of love poems. But then we know that he was sent into exile.
What he did wrong?
We don't know what he did wrong. And we don't really know what happened to him. There are some poems and letters that got back to Rome, but not many. So Malouf uses his imagination, hence the title, An Imaginary Life, or one of the meanings of the title. And the book is written in the first person as a monologue by Ovid. It's not even clear who it's addressed to. It could be addressed to, it's like a message in a bottle, really, from this village on the edge of the Black Sea. And it's about being in exile, but he's initially very resentful because no one there speaks Latin, and he doesn't know the local language, whatever it is, and he feels isolated and far from the action. And
like going on holidays sometimes.
Well, yeah, a bit like going on holidays, or We've all had times when we're somewhere we didn't necessarily want to be, or we missed where we thought we belonged. But the key event in the novel is that he has this encounter with a wild child who is not a member of the village, who they discover while on a hunting expedition. And the child appears to have been raised by animals, although it's not clear. So the book becomes a story really about that notion of what it is to be human, or what a wild human might be like. So it sort of joins that family of stories that, you know, like Caspar Hauser or the wild boy of, I can't remember now, there's a famous 18th century French text about a so-called wild boy and attempts to educate him. And Ovid forms a bond with this child and takes it upon himself to teach him to speak. And initially he thinks he's going to teach him Latin, and then he decides he'll teach him the local language, which he's beginning to learn. And of course, there's a sort of a reversal, because the child becomes his teacher and he starts to learn about nature and about life and about what it means to live in this landscape, and comes to terms with being where he is. And I don't want to give too much more away about the plot, but that's the basic premise.
And it sounds like all good literature, all good art, all good performance art, that we, the audience, are going to learn or start to think a bit more about ourselves, about the community we live in.
Yes, and about who we are and where we are. And we've devised the show to be a touring show, and the first outing will be in Fremantle at the Moores Building, which is what we call a found space. It's not a theatre. I'm going to say it's probably an old wool store or granary or something like that, because it's in the west end of Fremantle. It's down in Henry Street. It's a beautiful old building, but it's going to be cold, so bring warm clothes. There's no heating there. But our plan is to take this show on tour around regional WA and elsewhere.
Did I see you're going to Cossack, amongst other places?
We are. Well, we were going to be actually performing in Cossack first, which is up near Karratha, and finishing making the work there and doing it there for a few nights, and then bringing it down here. And for various reasons, there's many a slip twixt cup and lip, as they say. Karratha has postponed us till next year, so we've decided to go ahead and do the initial season in Fremantle and then see how we go. But basically the idea is to perform it in non-theatre spaces that have their own history and their own acoustic as well. And to perform it for those, to kind of remake it for each venue and for each community.
I know that building. It's got its own wonderful history. William Dalgetty Moore, I think, was responsible for its construction. He was a Fremantle merchant. His uncle, George Fletcher Moore, came out to Fremantle and settled in the Swan Valley just about a year after Governor Stirling set up the British colony here in 1829. But it was, and they both did well, but William Dalgetty did particularly well. His marks are all around Fremantle. And the space itself, it has everything you describe, and it can be cold, but it's an intimate setting when all is said and done. How many people is an ideal number for that space?
Look, I reckon about 40 people, I would say, and the way we're performing it, as you can probably see by the arrangement of chairs in here, is that the audience are sitting in a semicircle around me and my co-performer, Pavan Kumar Hari, who is a multi-instrumentalist musician. Pavan's also a dancer and a singer and an actor. But in this case, he's primarily an instrumentalist, playing multiple instruments. He can play almost anything he lays his hands on, but he's trained as a percussionist, but he also plays strings and keyboards.
I start to imagine what an instrumentalist playing the sorts of instruments feel playing with a percussionist background is going to do in relation to the setting. But tell me.
Yeah, I mean, the project actually began in conversation with a friend of mine, Kingsley Reeve, who is a sound designer for theatre. And Kingsley got in touch with me and he wanted to sort of go back to his roots and make a piece of theatre that didn't involve plugging anything in, basically, or imposing a large-scale technological sound design, which has become a bit of a reflex in theatre now. That there's a you know, we get kind of deluged with sound. I think it's the influence of film, particularly Hollywood film, that's created this sort of expectation that everything has to be acoustically treated and signalled. And next thing you know, the actors are all mic'd, and then you have what we see a lot now in main stage theatre. So we wanted to go back to basics and do something intimate and real, and use real instruments or objects making sounds. And so Kingsley is in fact the sound designer on the project, and he and I, you know, started devising this together. And then we brought in Parvin because of his instrumental skills. So we're very interested in the space, or in spaces like the Moores Building, where they have their own particular sound and their own particular frequencies and their own particular ambience, visually as well as acoustically, and their own sense of history. And we chose this particular story because there is a sense of place and a sense of accepting the nature of where you are, including its character and its sounds and its unique qualities.
Humphrey, you're, as I take it, acting in it, directing it, and you've written it.
Well, yes and no. I have a lot of help. I am acting in it. I'm the narrator, and I move around. It's not just a, you know, stand and deliver. So I am playing over the storyteller, and Parvin is performing with me, and he will actually be moving around the space as well, because there are different sound qualities there. And then I have a team of creative collaborators. James Berlin is assisting me with directing the show. So he's coming into rehearsals and he's giving us feedback on how things come across, and you know what works and doesn't work. And I mean, and James has a lot of ideas. He's an experienced director and theatre maker himself, and I need that feedback because I'm in it, as well as, you know, I guess I'm the director in the sense that I've kind of pulled the whole thing together, and I have a reasonably strong sense of the aesthetic of the work and how I want things to be, but I don't know without someone on the outside. And James is a marvellous collaborator in that respect. And then there's Kingsley, who is the sound designer, but also we've worked together in the past, and you know, he's also a collaborator who tells me what works and what doesn't. And Kingsley actually trained as an actor before training as a sound designer. Then there's Parvin himself. There's Zoe Atkinson, who is, you know, a very well-known set and costume designer in theatre and opera, you know, based in Perth but works nationally. And Zoe and I have worked together in the past, and so we have a lot of discussions about costume, about props, even about the instruments in terms of their visual appearance, about how the audience is set up, about whether or not we want to put, you know, a rug on the floor or introduce other objects. Even though the aesthetic is very minimal, it still has a visual sonography. And then there's Libby Clies, who is the producer on the show, who is responsible for the administrative side of things, including, but she actually found this hall. She got in touch with Fremantle Arts Centre, who currently, they run the Moore Building art space as a gallery space, but it was her idea for us to perform the show there. And Libby is also a performer and director and theatre maker. So I rely on everyone for input when it comes to the performance, the overall direction, and even the script, which after all, I wouldn't say I've written. David Malouf wrote the book. The words that the audience will hear are all David's words. I've just arranged them, I would say. I've adapted and arranged his text for performance. I mean, the novel is, it's not a long novel, it's probably a couple of hundred pages. The performance text is probably about 30 pages. And, you know, inevitably there are things that have to go. And there are discursive passages which are marvellous to read, but not necessarily to perform. And so I've adapted it, you know, much in the way that, you know, a composer or arranger might adapt an existing piece of music.
It'd be lovely if David could sit in and watch it all happening.
It would be. I mean, he lives on the other side of the country, and he's getting on. I mean, I've been in touch with him. He was incredibly generous about allowing us to do the adaptation. And I mean, obviously through his agent, but I did speak to him directly, actually. In fact, when we first decided that we wanted to do it, it was the first year of the pandemic. And so everyone was communicating via Zoom. I think we were in lockdown even here in Perth. Kingsley was in Sydney, so he was definitely in lockdown. And I emailed, you know, various possible contacts that I could find from my old copy of the book, the publisher then, and David's agent, both in Australia and in the UK. And I didn't hear anything for a long time. And then I got an email from his agent in Australia. It was 9 months later, saying, you know, the whole world came to a stop, even on email during that first year, saying, we're so sorry, we haven't, you know, it's taken us a while to, you know, get this information, but David is very happy for you to proceed. Here's his mobile number.
How wonderful.
Which I won't share with you or the listeners, but give him a call. Oh, he doesn't use email, so just give him a call. So I rang David Malouf, and he answered the phone straight away and was extremely friendly and said, you know, here are the people to email and contact, and I'll give you any support. And, you know, I posted him a hard copy of the first draft of the script. And so it's been quite a remarkable journey.
It really is quite exciting. You've got a hell of a team behind you who can pick up the knives, the forks, wash the plates, and then go and act and direct and do the sound. You've got everything happening. But let's talk a little bit more about you. This is not the first thing you've done a bit like this. You've stripped things down and produced this sort of idea before, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. I've done a few. I mean, I'm you know, like most freelance artists, I've got various strings to my bow. I work as a narrator of audiobooks. I've done that for like 25 years. I haven't narrated an imaginary life, actually, but I'd love to. I'm sure it's been done. And if not, I'll have a chat with David about it.
Well, give me his number and I'll give him a call.
Yeah, I will. But I work as a jobbing actor. I've worked with Black Swan. And I mean, I was in Melbourne for the first sort of 30-odd years of my career and then moved to Perth for various reasons. So I've worked, you know, around the country with theatre companies large and small. And I've worked as a director. But yes, I've also done adaptations. That's kind of become something that I've been interested in.
How did that happen? I'm really interested in this. So you start off life in Melbourne, you go off and do tertiary studies in England. You the other thing we haven't mentioned, I think you do a bit of drama turging along the way.
Yes.
You write, you act, the readers, the listeners will see with this story the various awards you've won for your acting. And I think you're directing. The plays you've written have received accolades. I mean, what was the, if it were a snake-like or a Byzantine-type story whereby you went from here to there, how did you do it?
how did I do it? Just I really just followed my nose, which is something that Ovid actually says in the story. Ovidius Publius Naso, which means the nose. He talks about following his nose, and he says he has a nose for news. He says Virgil has an ear, but he has a nose.
Well, you probably got bitted out of the Roman Empire. Right?
Well,
too much gossip.
That's right. He says, you know, you stick your nose into the wrong places, and then look where a nose gets you. I mean, I've always loved literature and reading, and you know, reading to my kids when they were little, and my dad read to me, and you know, I was a precocious reader, I suppose, at school, and I studied English language and literature at university, and the first theatre company that I collaborated with, or co-founded when I got back from England to Melbourne, was a company called Whistling in the Theatre in the 80s, and we specialised in doing adaptations. And that was an era when these big adaptations like the Mahabharata, the Peter Brook one, which I think came to Perth.
I did.
I think it was performed in the Quarry, wasn't it?
It was.
I saw it in Adelaide also, I think, in a big quarry.
Amazing thing.
And I saw that, and it was, you know, it went all night. And that had a big impact on me, actually. And I think around that time, Nicholas Nickleby, the RSC, did that. And I feel like there was another Dickens adaptation that was done in Perth that Simon Phillips was involved with back in the 90s. Great Expectations, I'm going to say. Anyway, there was a bit of a vogue for that kind of approaching theatre again, using literature, and also staging it in a way that was inventive and often quite minimal. I mean, the Peter Brook, although it was this extraordinary performance with a multicultural cast in the Quarry, there was no set, there were very few props, there were hardly any costume changes. It was really language and the bodies of the actors, the voices and bodies of the actors. And that's probably remained my sort of guiding principle as a theatre maker. And so I've continued on that path, that snaking Byzantine path. And when I moved to Perth, I started doing shows at the Blue Room, which listeners will know in Northbridge, which is a very intimate space.
It's not entirely different to the one we're in.
No. I mean, it's probably even smaller, but it's also, I mean, it's now a black box. Well, there are two black box theatres there, but it was originally an old school. Mm. And it's a lovely building with a marvellous ambience and acoustic. And I did a series of works there. Initially, I and Sophia Hall, who is a collaborator, we adapted and performed things together. We did a version of Bernard Schlink's The Reader, which is a novel people might know.
Yes.
Then I started a company of my own called Night Train, and we did some adaptations of Dostoevsky, The Grand Inquisitor from The Brothers Karamazov, and also a passage called Stavrogin's Confession from The Devils. I sort of combined them into one character. These were performances that usually involved another performer, either a musician or a co-performer or a dancer. We did an adaptation of Wish, Peter Galsworthy's novel, which I did with Daniel Michich, who's now in Sydney, at the Blue Room. And that was quite successful, and Perth Theatre Company remounted that. And then most recently, I did some adaptations of Kafka stories at the Blue Room called The Apparatus, followed by an adaptation of The Golem, which was really looking at that whole myth of the Golem as a kind of mirror for looking at the state of Israel, in fact, as a kind of creature that possibly gets out of the control of its makers. We won't go into that too much now, but
that's the pathway. Yeah, it is, and it's interesting your choice. I tried to go through my Russian literature period, Humphrey. I think I did reasonably well. And Kafka, well, we all, it seems, if we're interested in theatre, have had to confront that. But what for you was the attraction? And I'm interested in how you also brought this other person on stage, whether they were dancing or making music, what the intended dynamic always was for that.
Look, I feel that, I mean, this is not a solo performance.
No,
and actually, I don't think there's any such thing. I feel like I'm always, theatre is a collaborative art form by nature. But for me, there is something about the dynamic with the other person, even if it's, I mean, in the case of Wish, it was with Daniel Michich. We did two or three shows together. We did Orpheus and Eurydice, where we looked at a series of different poetic versions of that story, with my then wife Jess Ipkendance playing violin and various other instruments, and Danielle moving and me doing text. Then we did Wish, and we did a piece called Masks, which was based on a story that I'd written myself. The case of Parman is interesting because we performed together in a production of The Tempest, Shakespeare's The Tempest, a few years ago. That was a Black Swan production at the Octagon.
You won awards for that, didn't you?
And I can't remember. It's possible. I played Prospero and Parvin played Ariel. But not only did he play Ariel, he also created all the music live on stage, and he's a dancer as well. It was an incredible feat. Mm. And we kind of, we found a rapport on stage and off, but especially on stage. And I felt like this could be useful for telling this particular story.
So let's come back to this story. How did you, in that sense, happen upon it? Why did you think this was going to be the vehicle for what you're just about to open?
Look, that's a good question. I mean, Kingsley and I batted around a few ideas. He actually, I think, then said, "What about an imaginary life?" And I immediately went, "Oh, that's something I've always wanted to do." Now, why is that? I don't know. I feel like, in terms of my winding Byzantine path, I feel like I have an interest in the mythic. And although this isn't exactly mythic, it's got a kind of fable-like quality, not just because Ovid wrote the Metamorphoses, but there is something in this story that has a fable-like quality. And I've always been interested in transformation, I suppose, whether that means physical transformation, psychological transformation, theatrical transformation. And in this case, it is a story about two human beings, really, Ovid and this child, who kind of transform each other. And I think it is... Maalouf is very discreet. He's of a generation of writers who doesn't spell out, or who don't spell out, the meaning of the fable. The story is solidly set in the ancient world, but I feel that it has a lot to teach us about living here in Australia, or here wherever we're performing in Fremantle now, and about empires and the edges of empires and colonisation and the edges and ends of colonisation, and learning to live with people who already live somewhere. And none of that needs to be spelled out, but I think it's a powerful part of the story.
Distance from events, or locating a story and in a sense shearing it down to fable status, can be good for us to learn from.
I think so. I think I'm drawn to writers who, to me, there's something theatrical about a story that is, as you say, has something essential about it. And whether it's a myth or a fable or a Kafka type, I mean, Kafka's, they really are fables, I think, or almost parables, I would say, where the meaning isn't always obvious, but that means that they can speak to us across time and space, and I think we can learn a lot from them.
Humphrey, we're getting closer to the end of this chat. I'm interested in the practicalities of a production like this. There's the time when you were suddenly thinking this could be the vehicle for doing it, but in terms of starting on it, getting to Maalouf, talking, getting his approval, proceeding with the drafts and sending them around, talking to all of your collaborators, to the point at which you will be opening in Fremantle and not in Cossack on the 16th of July, just a fortnight and a day away. How long does something like this take to do?
Well, as you say, we started I started talking about this with my collaborators and getting in touch with David, you know, a couple of years ago, or even a few years ago. It was the beginning of the pandemic.
Yes.
So that's actually sometime in 2020, and it's now 2024. And then, I mean, things kind of move slowly, and then you apply for funding and you get it or you don't get it. And we had a creative development for 2 weeks at the end of the year before last, actually, in a different space where we talked really about the aesthetic of the work and the idea of it being a touring show in found spaces and what the sound would be. And, you know, we explored the text, and then I wrote another draft. And then, you know, we applied for more funding. And what happens is then suddenly everything accelerates. And suddenly, you know, woe to go rehearsing it and performing it. You know, it's about 3 weeks. I mean, we've been rehearsing the team as it exists now. We're now at the beginning of the second week of rehearsal, and there's one more week after that, and then there's the show. So it's sort of suddenly everything moves fast, and you have to be nimble and just trust that, you know, you'll you know, it will emerge fully formed from the head of Jove.
Well, using my snake-like Byzantine analogy of getting places, here's this young voracious reader, his father's reading to him, he goes off and journeys the world, finishes up in England, but finishes up doing all of these things, narrating books which must keep you busy when you're not busy. Did you have some sense that this is what you wanted to do, that you wanted to be an actor primarily, or did you want to be a writer, or did you, what did you want to be? Humphrey, tell us.
Michael, I think I just, like Ovid, I just followed my nose, honestly. I did the things that I enjoyed. You know, I loved reading and literature, I enjoyed writing, then I, you know, got the acting bug, as people say, which really, you know, consumed a lot of my university years. I didn't go to drama school, but I, you know, came back to Melbourne from Oxford, and, you know, I started a series of unfinished higher degrees, actually, in English and in literature and various things, but kept being drawn back to the theatre, you know, got together with other people and started this theatre group, Whistling in the Theatre, and really one thing led to another, and that's really how it's been.
Now, one final question, in a sense, left field with everything else that we've been talking about, but when our listeners go and do the proverbial Google, Humphrey, and they find that you do all of this narrating of books and you've got all of these voices, where did you find all of those voices?
Oh, that's a big question. I mean, I probably tend to use different voices for different characters in audiobooks more than a lot of other narrators. A lot of narrators narrate in their own voice, regardless of dialogue, which I think is absolutely fine. I mean, a lot of actors do that on stage as well. It goes back to this theme of transformation, doesn't it? There's something about transforming physically, vocally, you know, inside, that's always appealed to me about acting. Where they come from is another question, which I don't really know the answer to. It's something about my own interior responding to the text and my imagination, and beyond that I can't really say. It's a bit of a mystery.
Well, I'm sure An Imaginary Life, a new theatrical adaptation by Humphrey Barr, is going to be a great success. Just so people don't have to read, they can just listen to us tell them once again that it's not the Moores Building Art Space, 46 Henry Street in Fremantle. It's Indigenous Wadjuk name, Walyalup, and it starts on the 16th of July, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. People need to book soon.
Yeah, there's only those performances.
And they need to get on to HumanTix, buy their tickets and make sure, because there's only going to be about 40 people who can get into the space each night.
That's right. That's right. So yeah, if you are interested in seeing the show, please book now.
Humphrey, thanks for meeting with me. It's been lovely talking to you.
Thanks, Michael. It's been a pleasure.